Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy, powered by TrustArc. Here are your hosts, Dr. Kay Royal and Paul Breitmark.
Hello. Y'all want a little bit different something this week? Here's how we actually record the beginning of some of our episodes until we know exactly what we're going to be covering.
Yada, 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 yada. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So, Paul, we've got quite a few things this week, and so I'm going to go with the first icebreaker question. Where did you grow up?
In the Netherlands.
In the country or a city?
Both.
You don't have to give details of address, but...
Well, no, I was born in Rotterdam, at the time still the biggest port in the world.
Okay.
And when I was 8, we moved to the southern border of the country. That's about an hour away, just to give you a bit of perspective.
Okay. I was going to say, so you're a southern boy, but we're only talking an hour.
We're only talking an hour. And this is the southwestern part of the Netherlands on the Belgian border.
Okay.
That's where I spent most of my youth. Studied in my, and then spent a year in Bordeaux in France, 6 months in Brussels for my internship. And ever since I started working, I've been living in The Hague.
Nice.
Which by now is almost 20 years, scarily
wow.
enough.
Wow. Very nice. I grew up, I think we've talked about it before, poor girl from Mississippi. As a matter of fact, it was, mine's not near as sexy and fascinating as yours. We grew up outside the town called Meridian and only had a population of about 30,000 back then. And that was of the surrounding areas, but we were not inside the city limits. I actually grew up in a place that the only place it exists is on the elector rolls. It's called Nellieburg. But it's interesting that one of my favorite authors was at a Comic-Con one time, and she's from Tennessee, I think. And when I went up to get her signature, I was in Arizona, and she's like, oh, you're not from here. I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm actually from a really small town in Mississippi. She's like, oh, what's the name? I said, Nellieburg. She went, just north of Meridian before you get to Collinsville? I was like, woohoo, my favorite author knows. But I mean, I didn't leave Mississippi till I was nearly 30. And took my first to Tennessee, then jumped to Arizona, and then there moved to Texas and California, then back to Arizona, now over to South Carolina. But I never intended to move back to the South, and I think I've mentioned that before.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it's not in the deep, deep South. But I guess it's because I spent so long trying to escape it. But I used to joke that, you know, when I would get a new husband, I would get a new degree, and I would move to a new state.
Which is more or less what you did.
Right. Husband number three in Arizona with the law degree, and he moved us to Texas. So I told him that was his fault if I got husband number four. But I did get degree number four. I got the PhD. So
you didn't get husband number four.
He said, it's all right. He said, we can get remarried again. I'll be your husband number four. Because I told him I already had the color wedding dress picked out I wanted to wear. He's like, great, we'll just get married again.
So make sure you invite me and all of our listeners when you ever
exactly,
do that.
Exactly. So there we go. So that's where we grew up. That's where we landed. That's where we are. So we have a lot to talk about. I think the sexier things to talk about are on your side of the world. So I'm gonna throw out here quickly that Kentucky has passed a privacy law from the House and the Senate. I believe it's on the way to governor. I think is that where it is? Maybe I'm a little bit ahead of myself here, but I think it's on its way to the governor. It's modeled after the Virginia privacy law, so we might start seeing. Surprises me, as you know my prediction, that we're not going to see much after the first couple of months of the year. So it surprises me to see yet another privacy law making its way through And maybe this is a sign of how important privacy is turning out to be for people. So maybe people are starting to listen, people in power, people in politics are starting to listen. So I'm surprised. So I can't take bets on how many more we're going to see, but Kentucky passed a privacy law.
Which is also, for me, somewhere in the South.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's more hill country.
I associate Kentucky with fried chicken and deep fried stuff is in the South.
But it's Southern with gorgeous, gorgeous mountains there. I love the mountains. I love the mountains in Tennessee. So when you're a Mississippi girl and you don't have mountains, the Smoky Mountains are absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I've even walked so high up in the mountains at the clouds.
Yeah, that's cool.
You're walking through the clouds. It's beautiful. So when we moved to Arizona and they saw the Rocky Mountains, my girls who were 7 and 9 were like, what are those? I'm like, those are mountains. And they're like, no, they're not. Those are big rocks. Everybody on the plane just died laughing because, you know, kids don't keep it to themselves. So anyway, so I love seeing this coming from the South because people have this idea that the South is really, really backwoods and it's not progressive. And that's not necessarily true for all places. There are some places of the South that are, don't get me wrong, but they're pockets, not full states. And so to see Kentucky also passing a privacy law, Tennessee's passed a privacy law, Mississippi was one of the front runners. I really love seeing this. I think it's great. But okay, so that's basically it for the U.S.
Well, I have two sexy abbreviations for you.
Let's go.
It's either TCF or AI. What do you want to start with?
Ooh, let's start with TCF because I think we can knock it out quicker because we did a whole episode on the TCF and this controversy that's going over. Let me see if I can recall the details off the top of my head. This has to do
January 22.
Yes, it's TCF with their framework and they have a TC string. And the TC string was determined to be personal information. I think the other very controversial part of the opinion that came down that they argued, which is important for the decision, is that they argued they are not a controller. And based on the decisions they were making of whether or not the companies following the TCF were in compliance with their framework, they made those decisions. And so therefore, under the initial opinion, they were a controller. So that's one of the things that they appealed first.
Yeah, I think I would give you a B minus for that.
Okay.
But you're close enough. So let's go back in the...
And believe it or not, I read the opinion.
Let's go back to late 2021, early 2022.
Oh, yes, when the times were simpler.
While we were in lockdown. So yeah, times were very simple because we couldn't do shit. Excuse my French. The Belgian Data Protection Authority back in the day came down with a ruling against the Interactive Advertising Bureau, their European branch, IAB Europe. They have developed indeed a transparency and consent framework, TCF, that is used for cookie compliance, but also for online marketing, online advertising, especially for behavioral advertising and a thing called real-time bidding, which is the live auctioning off of advertisement on websites.
Right, which happens instantaneously. I mean, like less than instantaneously. So it's not like an auction website you go to like Katawiki and you bid on things.
We take a week and they take a fraction of a second.
Not even a breath. Exactly. So something that a lot of people are not accustomed to and don't realize, but real-time bidding is a big, big part of the advertising world.
Exactly. So the Belgian DPA got some complaints and they investigated and came to the conclusion, indeed, this model is not compliant with GDPR and e-privacy legislation, even though IAB claimed that it was developed especially with the purpose of GDPR compliance in mind.
Not really, and no.
The Belgian DPA said, well, there are a few faults here because A, you are processing personal data, the TC string, which captures all those preferences and links all the things together for the auction. That is personal data.
Oh, no, it's not.
Do not have a good legal ground to process it. Plus, as IAB, you are a data controller or maybe a joint data controller because you determine purpose and means of the processing operation. Yeah. IAB did not agree. Yeah. They filed a complaint to the Belgian Markets Court and they asked some prejudicial questions to the Court of Justice in Luxembourg. And that ruling came down last week on the 7th of March. And the court said, well, the court set out to clarify the rules on online auctions and said, no, the TC string can be personal data, especially if it is in combination with a cookie that can be linked to the user's IP address, because then it becomes identifiable.
If I recall our prior session on this, which I did not go back and listen to in preparation for this, but if I recall, you and I were actually saying it is possible that on appeal that a court may say the TC string itself is not always personal data. It depends on what's included with it, and maybe they could modify it to where it only included certain information. There was a little bit debate over there, but the second point on whether or not they were a controller or acted in a controller capacity, whether joint or not, none of us seemed to think that was up for debate. We were really surprised that they had the moxie to challenge that.
Yes, but they did.
They lost.
Because also there, the Court of Justice said, no, they are a data controller, probably a joint data controller, pending confirmation by the Belgium court. But it's very likely they should be regarded as a joint controller under the GDPR, because IAB Europe, together with their local branches and the advertisers, controls the whole processing operation of the real-time bidding.
Yeah.
And if you are a data controller, it doesn't mean that you are responsible for the whole data processing operation from start to finish. It can also be that you are only responsible in part, but that still makes you a joint data controller. And I think that is probably the most important part of this case, which also has a lot of relevance for other data processing operations where multiple parties are involved, is that the court very clearly states you are also a data controller if you are not involved in the whole data processing operation.
Right.
And but do determine part of the purpose and means for that operation.
Absolutely. And I think one of the pieces of evidence, and I know it's a small piece of what they do, but to me, it was a very compelling piece of evidence that they do. And as I mentioned, they determine whether or not their clients are compliant with their TCF. I keep wanting to say the TCF framework, but the TCF is the framework. They determine whether or not their clients are compliant with the TCF and determine whether or not they can use their services, which means they're evaluating how the data is being used, which means they're telling their clients how the data can be used. And if that's not determining the means and the purposes of the processing, I don't know what is.
No, I agree. And for me, this decision is not a surprise, because we've maintained for a long time that the real-time bidding advertising model is not sustainable, because it is a model that is developed outside of the legal boundaries.
Right. And now, for those of you who may not have known Paul for very long, he has always hated this. He's always...
Yes.
Okay, hated is a strong word, but probably
no, hated
apt.
Is correct.
Is it probably apt, regardless whether it's a strong word or not?
Because, I'm not a fan.
Because it was built on consent, and you cannot have cookies based on consent, advertising cookies based on consent.
Well, in theory, you can.
I mean, it has to be consent, right?
So, yeah, but not for 527 of our most trusted partners in one go.
Exactly. So they should be based on consent. You cannot base it on legitimate interest, which was an underlier of a lot of it as well. It was the underlying justification for cookies was legitimate interest. It needed to be consent. So I know I said that backwards. Consent has to be there, but you also can't consent for 500, 500,000, 1,000. You can't consent for all of those at one time and truly embody the purpose of consent, to be fully informed and knowledgeable about what you're consenting to and be able to revoke that consent at the same time. It's just not sustainable, as Paul says.
Plus, there is something also like not having bundled consent.
Yeah.
You can't bundle your consent in your terms and conditions. Then why would you be able to bundle one consent for 527 different kinds of advertising?
Yeah.
Also there, it just doesn't, connect with the logic of the law.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, they don't seem to have appealed the legitimate interest part that was also stricken down. It's still live. I mean, pending all these court cases, IAB has not made any significant changes to the TCF.
No, didn't they propose a new framework, changes to their framework, come forth with a new framework the Belgium court said they could propose?
Yeah, they did propose some changes, but all of those are also still pending while this is
the court's going through.
So this is now back with the court in Belgium. They will have to make a final determination in the next couple of months. And then we'll see what IAB will be doing and how this will all play out in reality. But you see that the Court of Justice is becoming pretty vocal where it comes to online advertising.
Yeah.
Because in the past year, this is the second landmark case, I would say, where it comes to online advertising, together with Meta v. Bundeskartellamt last year, which led to the prohibition of personalized behavioral advertising from the European DPAs for all data collected on Facebook and Instagram.
At some point, we're going to have people on the podcast that can talk about what is the future of companies that make their living from advertising. I know the one that we just released was about advertising as well, but I would actually like to talk to someone that's like these companies that have built their living based on online advertising and targeted behavioral advertising and cookies. And is that sustainable as a business model? I mean, it's going to exist one way or the other. You're going to you're going to use contextual advertising, which a lot of people don't like, because then you have to figure out what the context is, or you're just going to be placing ads, which was not as much money making as targeted behavioral advertising and profiling across sites. So the industry has been hit hard. I mean, Apple also hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
When they did that. So the industry has been hit very hard. How sustainable?
And Google will hurt them now as well with the third-party cookies that are deprecated.
Exactly. And their Google Analytics 4 is supposed to be a little better privacy-wise, not necessarily money-wise, maybe, but privacy-wise. But I mean, there are trillions of dollars in advertising tech and marketing and everything. So it's not going to go away. You're not going to all of a sudden see all advertisings from online disappear, but it's going to have to move to a new business model.
It should. And that also means that there will be more focus on the pay or okay model and the conditions under which pay or okay would be allowed. Because with advertising becoming less relevant, less effective, obviously, companies will need to look for other business models.
Data brokers. They're going to sell all the data they collect. They're just not going to advertise to you because of it.
But that's possible in the US, but that is a lot less possible in the European Union because they would not have a legal basis to do so. It happens, but it's also a matter of time before data protection authorities will intervene there and really start enforcing against those companies. So a lot is changing, and I think in the short run, the cost per acquisition for a lot of companies looking for new customers will also go up, because otherwise they will not be able, I mean, with advertising becoming less relevant, or you need more advertisement to reach that same person, it will become more expensive.
Yeah, the other day I got really frustrated. And I'm sure all of my privacy peeps out there feel this same frustration. I'm on a mobile website and open it up and it pops up with a cookie thing and it's accept.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And then in very faint font, which are the dark patterns, very faint font, it had cookie choices. Privacy notice or something, more information. So I clicked on that and it went to the privacy notice, and absolutely nowhere in the privacy notice was anywhere whatsoever for me to trigger a cookie consent choice. If I closed the privacy notice, it had the screen. I could not close the screen without consenting. There wasn't even an X. My only option was to click to the privacy notice or to click on accept.
And why have a banner in the first place?
I was so frustrated. I'm like, and I think it was some site that had something to do with privacy or something like that. Anyway, so I was just frustrated with the whole model.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
this is the TCA.
How long is it going to take for the final decision to come down? I know things in Europe tend to work a little bit slower than we like. As we said, we did this back in 2022.
Yeah, it depends a bit on the Belgian court. I don't know what their workload is, so I don't know what their regular speed would be. But I would say this side of the summer break.
Yeah. Nice.
Clarity.
Nice. And they've been waiting on this to come through.
Yes, obviously. So.
Yeah, this is a very important decision. Absolutely. So let's move to the second sexy set of letters you gave me on the AI Act. We have not talked about this.
No, and let me start with some other AI things before we do that.
Oh,
I'm I'm also playing around with AI a little bit to help educate myself. I need to know how it works to be able to give better recommendations. So
I'm taking a class on it, and I did the first and second week, and then I had to go to Europe, and then I had something happen, and then something else happened, and then the puppy got hurt, and now I'm in the sixth week of the course, and I haven't done anything since the second week.
Yeah, that's why I don't take classes. I only give, only teach them.
Well, it's only a six-week course. It's through the MIT, AI, whatever, and I've done a course through them before. I liked it. Yeah, I'm having to see if they can move my course to a different cohort or something and let me
try again. So while playing around with some of the tools, because we also have a team day in the coming week where we talk about AI. So I wanted to test a few things, including the new Google Gemini, previously Google Bard.
Yeah.
The images have already been pulled because they were now, previously the images were considered to be too biased, and now they are too biased on the other end of the spectrum.
People are doing a lot of image poisoning. So
there was overcorrection.
Yes.
But one of the things I asked Google Gemini is, what can you tell me about the Serious Privacy Podcast?
Ooh, he hasn't shared this with me, people. He knows I don't use generative AI.
So I will record this in a computer voice and then added that part in. But
okay.
So I asked Google, what can you tell me about the Serious Privacy Podcast? The Serious Privacy Podcast is a great resource for anyone interested in learning more about data privacy and security. Here's a breakdown of what you can expect. Focus. Serious Privacy dives into in-depth discussions on a wide range of privacy topics, from data management and cybersecurity to social justice and ethics. Hosts. The show is hosted by Dr. Kay Royal and Paul Breitbart, who foster open, unscripted conversations with privacy professionals. It's like eavesdropping on informative kitchen table chats with industry experts. Target audience. Whether you're a professional looking to stay up to date on the latest privacy issues, or somebody who simply wants to understand how your data is being used, Serious Privacy has something for you. Content. With over 150 episodes, there's a wealth of content to explore. You can find the podcast on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and their website. Overall, Serious Privacy is a reputable source for serious discussions on privacy.
Ooh, not bad.
Not bad at all. I do like that it's like eavesdropping on informative kitchen table chats with industry.
Yeah, instead of the back porch. Yeah, okay.
No, I mean the eavesdropping part. For a privacy podcast, I think that's very funny.
I think it is, for eavesdropping on kitchen table conversations. There we go. I like it. So yeah, I don't use generative AI. I do try to learn more about it. I have played with a little bit of the image. I think I shared before I did AI headshots, where I uploaded, 15 of my own photos, and then they generated 20 images. Only about two of them really looked like they were me, which made no sense to me. And then you can turn those back in to get enhancements on them by uploading other photos to enhance them. So yes, I went through this of uploading my photos. Now, it was better than the image generator on Facebook, which, oh my gosh, was in so much trouble for generating all these fantasy and fairy and pirate and obscene images of women when there were no nude photos uploaded. But this one was an AI headshot. I wanted to see what people were talking about. It's not an AI headshot, people. It didn't work. I trust my photographer much, much better, and she does magic with no photo retouches that are absolutely amazing. I'll stick with that. Thank you. Yeah. But for the wording, I've never used it.
I have, also just to see how it improves and to understand what's happening there. And being in a company that is primarily a tech company, I need to understand this, because sooner or later, it will be part of what we are doing. And even our sponsor is using generative AI now.
Yes, they are, which I'm excited about. I'm sorry. Okay, I did use that one. Let me back down. We're doing the beta testing. I did use Nimity AI. I am very excited for this. It's like a tailored search within a huge database. Okay, it's not like a tailored search within a huge database. It is a tailored search
within a huge database.
Within a huge database. Nimity has more resources and research and sources of privacy and cybersecurity law than any other resource I know of. And to be able to get that information out is not always the easiest thing anymore. Those of us that have been using Nimini for a while know where to get it, but sometimes you just want to go in and type in what you need and see what it comes out with. And they're doing
That's what Nimini AI is doing. And I mean, it's 45,000 references already in there, plus more than 12 maps, charts. There is tons of information.
News sources, tracking databases, enforcement.
We have
decisions.
The advertising at the start and end of this podcast for a reason.
We know. We're sorry.
We both love Nimity Research, but this will be a great way to experience it in a new way. I've done my first searches and they've actually given me some nice results.
Nice.
For what I expected.
Some more searches.
Yep, I want to try more. But the good news is that from March 27, anybody can join the beta release. So if you go to trustark.com.
And we'll try to put the link in the notes as well, or wherever we paste it as well. So we're excited about this.
Nimity AI beta. There you will find the website where you can sign up for this trial. I'm excited. This is just something that I'm dying to try for the next research that comes up, just to see what the output will be. So that's the first experiences. Luckily, this is an AI system without any significant impact on a human being. So this is not something that can be considered as a high-risk system under the EU AI Act. See what I did there?
I did. You segued that so nicely.
So today, Wednesday, 13 March, the European Parliament adopted the EU AI Act. The member states will still need to give their consent. They will do so in the next couple of weeks once the lawyer linguists have finished all of the translations into all EU languages. But that's a matter of time. And then it will be published in the official journal. So also this side of the summer, probably somewhere late April, early May, we will see the EU AI Act in the books.
Yep.
And then 6 months from then, the first parts will enter into force. And then 2 years from then, the final parts will also take effect. And the EU AI Act is the first global binding piece of legislation specifically designed for artificial intelligence.
And it is put forth as a consumer protective mechanism. As Paul said, you know, Nimity AI is one that doesn't impact a specific individual or just a significant decision on an individual's rights and freedoms. So it is positioned as a consumer protection mechanism. And just like the GDPR, this will be a driving force for laws across the world. Absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever. It takes a risk-based approach, which pretty much everything in data protection does. It's based on the risk. And so, and here's the thing. Don't take a kinda, sorta risk-based approach. Really look at the risks and look at the risks from the perspective of the individuals that you are impacting. Now, you don't necessarily have to take it down to the level of, would Kay be impacted by this? Or would Paul be impacted by this when you're doing your risk assessments and looking at what to do? It would be, would the average person, would the reasonable person be impacted? Would it have this? Now, when it does come to that individual and an impact on that person, you absolutely need to take an individual approach. But for your general rules and putting it into place, it doesn't. I think one of the interesting things is also the facial recognition technology. So this also very much addresses facial recognition technology, which is absolutely a controversial practice around the world. Here in the U.S., we don't have a lot of bans on it. You do when you have the Illinois biometric and whatever. But most of what you're going to see on facial recognition technology here in the U.S. is going to be on a city level. Mm-hmm. That it won't let law enforcement use live facial recognition technology. They can use it in retrospect, but they can't use it live because bad things happen when you mistake someone for someone else based on FRT.
Yeah.
So, Paul, tell us a little bit more about the AI Act and provisions of it, what you're more worried about, what you're more proud of.
So to start with the facial recognition, indeed, there is a generic prohibition in the law to scrape facial data from the internet or CCTV footage to create facial recognition databases. So bye-bye Clearview AI. emotion recognition in the workplace, tools, social scoring, predictive policing, all of that is out of bounds, bar very few, very limited exceptions for
like TSA.
Like border control, but also there it is very restrictive what can be done. Also, real-time biometric identification can only be deployed under very strict safeguards. So it needs to be limited in time, limited in geographic scope, prior judicial or administrative authorization. So no blanket biometric facial recognition things you see in TV shows that they can just use CCTV cameras and identify somebody in real time. That's not allowed.
Yeah. Now here's a scenario let me give to you. So the professor I teach with, a very, very well-known professor in science and innovation, Gary Marchant. So Gary Marchant is the professor I teach with. He's the head of the Center for Law, Science, and Innovation at Arizona State University, the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, of which I am on the board of that center. Also a teaching and a research fellow, blah, blah. Okay, I've given you all the good things. He has gone to Ireland and consulted with the authorities in Ireland about using facial recognition technology at their big stadium and how they want to use it. And you can do it in two different ways. One, you can scan all the faces and see if something ding, 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 ding pops up on someone in the audience. The other one is you scan all faces, but you're looking for a select number of faces. You're not looking if Paul's face pings on something. Does Kay's face ping on something? Does your face ping on something? It's looking at Paul, Kay, and you and everybody else's faces, and does it ping on these 10 or these 50 individuals on the most wanted? So there are two different ways of looking for it. One of them is much, much work intensive, more work intensive. The other one has a lot less errors. So how does it speak to that?
You want to use a hit, no hit system.
Yeah.
Well, these things, that is probably, this would be ruled out because it's real-time biometric identification. And that could only be used in very specific cases. So, for example, if you are searching for a missing person or to prevent an imminent terrorist attack and you are looking for somebody who's on the watch list.
Someone specific, yeah.
Someone is specific. Then you might be able to use that technology in a limited space, a limited geographic area. But the generic facial recognition in stadiums, I don't believe that that would be possible anymore. But there is a lot more reading to do on these specific elements, obviously. In any case, for any high-risk system that you deploy, so anything that may have consequences, serious consequences of harm for the individual, harm to health, harm to safety, to fundamental rights, to the environment, to democracy and the rule of law, in all of those cases, you need to do a fundamental rights impact assessment before you can even consider to deploy it, and not just do the assessment, but also then find ways to mitigate those risks. That all needs to be documented. When you are working on general purpose AI systems, such as generative AI's large language models, that is allowed, but you need to comply with EU law, including EU copyright law, for all the data that you use for training. You need to publish what data you actually have used for training and how you have obtained that.
And you have to label it if you create artificial images or deepfake videos or something. So the one that's taken the world by storm lately, which I don't know why it did, was the photo that came out from
the Pope in the Balenciaga coat.
Well, that one I was thinking, but I was thinking just recently this past week on Princess Kate.
Oh, yes. But that's not AI generated. That was just a Photoshop.
Was a Photoshop gone bad? But for some reason, it makes people all up in arms. Is that a deep fake picture? No, clearly it's not a deep fake picture. But it does bring into that. So the people who are going to use deep fake videos for bad purposes are not going to label them as deep fake videos. Let's be honest.
No, absolutely. And all of that needs to be labeled, and also that will be supervised. There is a lot of work still ahead because the supervision, of course, will be a battle between multiple supervisory authorities. We know that some of the data protection authorities have also already positioned themselves as we want to be the supervisory authority, including in France and here in the Netherlands.
Well, I thought it was interesting that the companies that have the really powerful generative AI, so as you said, Google's Gemini, they have to report if there are serious consequences that arise from their generative AI, such as a death or I don't know what else, serious harm to health or person, any significant legal consequences that arise to someone because
people losing their job because of fake news that was generated because of AI.
Yeah. And I mean, this takes me back to, and this came up as well last year when we were talking about the AI at the IAPP Global Privacy Summit, where they did the wonderful poem about K is my name. Don't spell it that way. I like it. It's someone in the census man. But anyway, and it talks about a woman whose middle name's the letter K. Regardless, that whole thing makes me think about how the deepfake videos are used in non-consensual pornography. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about, can you have unintended, intended or unintended, very serious consequences to someone based on AI? Yeah, people can lose their jobs. They can have people break into their house.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is a lot of work to do. One of the parliament's rapporteurs for this law has also stated earlier today, the EU has delivered. We have linked the concept of artificial intelligence to the fundamental values that form the basis of our society, but much work lies ahead, and that goes beyond the AI Act itself. And I think that is a very true statement. This is the law, but we saw also with the GDPR, we are still working on operationalizing it.
Oh, yeah.
And that will also be the same for AI. There will be companies that will try to release some things that they know that they won't be able to release anymore 2 years down the road. Do it quickly now that they are not yet covered under this legal requirement. And there will companies who will try to ignore this or challenge every single bit of it.
Absolutely.
Before the courts.
And countries and states will look at passing laws. I mean, there have been hundreds upon hundreds of laws proposed that have never made it into law. They've never passed both houses. They've never been signed into law. China has its own proposed AI law, I believe. President Biden has issued executive orders from the White House. We expect there to be agreements and laws that derive from that. But now they're either going to take a turn for they want to model after the European AI, or they're going to take a turn and say, we want to be different. So just know that this means there's going to be changes out there if you've been following laws and developments and things like that. So it's going to be really interesting to watch how this develops. When do you think we're going to have some adoption and some final guidance on this?
So the adoption should be somewhere in May, my best guess.
Okay.
Which means that the first provisions of the law
go into effect.
Namely, the prohibited use cases, those will enter into effect by the end of this year, 6 months after entry into force. And then 24 months after, the whole law will be effective.
I thought you were going for prohibitabido.
No.
My husband loves that movie. I'm sorry, it's a cheerleading movie, but he absolutely loves that movie.
Never seen it.
Never seen it. Oh my gosh. But he loves prohibitabido. So, but yes. So again, brace yourselves, people. This isn't the end all. This is only the beginning, but it's the beginning of something real. Exactly.
This is the end of the beginning. It is the beginning of something new. I'm excited.
Yes.
And of course, the burden is on the companies that develop these large-scale AI systems. If you are implementing AI technology, for example, using an API of one of the large language models, this is not immediately on you. You still need to meet the transparency requirements, but the building of the system, that is with your vendor. So that does have an impact on your vendor management.
Oh, absolutely.
And that is already the case, if I'm being honest, because almost every single SaaS tool is rolling out artificial intelligence right now.
You have to read between the lines. You got to pay attention. I own TPRM as well as the privacy program. So it is absolutely something that we're faced with on a nearly daily basis. So we do the risk assessments on it. But I noticed that in TrustArc, when I was documenting one of my processes, there's now a selection for whether or not the process uses AI.
Yes. And that's important because there are a lot of tools that use AI, but what is happening with your data when they use AI?
Yeah.
Is your data being used for training purposes? What
Absolutely.
About copyright? What about infringements? What about safeguards? What about liability?
Well, and if you're a vendor, what about your client's data? Is this something that you have permission from your client to be able to use? Are you safeguarding it? So expect to see a lot of changes come through.
Yes.
Expect to see a lot of changes come through. So
our work already wasn't boring, and it's just gotten more fun.
Don't you hate it when people say, oh, but job security for you? I don't know about y'all people, but I got enough security.
For a couple of decades, yes.
Right?
And on that happy note, we'll end another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like us, join the conversation on LinkedIn. Like and subscribe. Please subscribe because that's good for our numbers.
Yeah.
In your favorite podcast app or on your favorite podcast platform, you'll find Kay on social media as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Until next week, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.